This is Culturetopia, a weekly look at NPR's best in movies, books, TV, music, and culture. I am Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And all of the stories that we are going to be talking to you about today will be available at npr.org/culturetopia.
This week, we will travel the world with a location scout whose job it is to pick the places where movies are made. We'll chat with author Colson Whitehead, best known for his novel The Intuitionist, and we'll hear from critic Kenneth Turan, reviewing the latest Star Trek film.
But first, Baker's Keyboard Lounge in Detroit is one of the oldest continuously operating jazz clubs in the world. It opened in 1934, and the club's current owner was looking forward to some raucous 75th anniversary celebrations. But now, Baker's very survival is in doubt. From member station WDET, Rob St. Mary reports.
The roster on the Baker's website is staggering. Singers and soloists from Ella Fitzgerald to Miles Davis, John Coltrane to Thelonious Monk, and even comedian Lenny Bruce have performed there. Motown players hone their chops on the checkerboard stage between sessions. Ed Love has been a jazz DJ in Detroit for almost 50 years.
I knew young musicians in New York and around the country. I knew old musicians, you know, veterans, and all of them had to play Baker's.
Love says musicians would call him to pull strings to get them into Baker's because he says playing there would guarantee bigger gigs around the country. Saxophonist James Carter was born in Detroit.
It's not only a rite of passage for musicians, but it's also a rite of passage for patrons as well. They can say that they've been to Birdland. This is right on par.
Baker's has suffered along with the rest of Detroit, as auto jobs have evaporated and home foreclosures have hit record highs. Owner John Colbert is sitting in Baker's ebony and ivory-themed club room, and he speaks about the club's current fate with a laid-back resignation.
The struggles of Baker's is the struggles of everyone right now. It's in a depressed economy, and we're no different than anyone. We're in line.
Colbert says his troubles grew when the city of Detroit put in a new water meter and then retroactively billed him for what he thought he had already paid in estimated bills.
Just one bill came in at one time, and it was in the area of $27,000, I believe.
Colbert says he has yet to settle with the water department because it's been unable to answer his questions about the retroactive billing. Our calls to the water department were not returned. All of this leaves one of the oldest jazz clubs in the world in a precarious state. Beyond the economic troubles, Colbert says the business has changed. The big names in jazz now mostly play concert halls.
It's hard to maintain the standard which was upheld for so long here when all the greats now don't come to the club anymore. Many of them are dead. But the biggest part is those who follow the tradition of playing acoustic jazz, the numbers are few.
Baker's had its 75th anniversary this weekend, but Colbert says the club could close soon. He hasn't set a date because he's hoping that won't happen. So is musician James Carter.
To not have this place, God forbid, would be a travesty to American culture, the culture at large here in Detroit. It would be sonic, musical, social castration.
Carter became a part of the club's history with his 2004 album, Live at Baker's.
Still got to come back here, you know, and make sure the home fires are burning properly with a nice little crackle in them. This certainly is one of the places that provides that. Without it, it'll be cold, and no electric blanket will save you from that.
Between hot jazz and hot sauce on every table, club owner John Colbert says he's doing everything he can to attract audiences. And he says business has picked up since word of Baker's plight began to circulate.
Our business went up 25%, but remember, our decline was 40%, so we're not there yet.
Colbert, who bought the club about a decade ago, says he hopes the Baker's legacy won't end with him. But if he has to, he'd like to sell the club to someone else who will continue the tradition. For NPR News, I'm Rob St. Mary in Detroit.
Well, you know, a few weeks ago, we did a piece on the podcast about filming movies in Detroit. Location manager Kokai Ampa has worked on films ranging from The Color Purple to The Shawshank Redemption to The Soloist. NPR's own Michelle Norris spoke with Ampa about the art of the location scout.
What is the toughest location you've had to find?
You know, they're all tough until you've found it, and then it's over, and then it's like, and I guess this is what they say about childbirth. You know, it's so hard, and then it's over. One of the more interesting ones was finding a black sand beach to create a war for Flags of Our Fathers.
Island X is an ugly, smelly, dirty little scab of rock called Iwo Jima. It means sulfur island, which accounts for the smell. Looks sort of like a burnt pork chop, you ask me. For 20 straight days of bombing, you won't find a blade of grass or a twig on it.
Now, that was one of the six films you worked on with Clint Eastwood. And as I understand, he insisted on a black sand beach. No substitutions.
Well, really, he wasn't that, you know, specific. But with Clint, everything is kind of low-key, you know. And so anyway, we went out and set out to find black sand beaches. And, of course, we started with Hawaii. And it didn't work. The beaches either weren't long enough, wide enough. But the other problem was it was very tropical, and it didn't fit the look of Iwo Jima after it had been pounded by bombshells for a month, as it did in the actual battle. And then the other situation was that there were beaches that had nesting turtles, and you can't run tanks and gunfire and all that on a beach that has nesting turtles. It just, they don't match. They don't work out. And as I was on the Big Island getting gas with the film commissioner, the owner of the gas station knew the film commissioner, and he came to me and said, "So what are you doing? What are you looking for?" And I told him, black sand beaches to do a war. And I told him it was about Iwo Jima. He said, "Oh, yeah, like they have in Iceland." And I just stopped. And I said, "Iceland?" And next thing you know, we were off scouting Iceland.
And what'd you find when you got there?
We found great black sand beaches that didn't have nesting turtles, that didn't have foliage because it's a very young volcanic island, and we would be able to move sand around. The Japanese in the Battle of Iwo Jima built a large berm, a high berm of sand, and the black sand is very soft. So the GIs had to hit the beach and then climb this hill of sand, which would give way underneath them. So it made it a double, along with the bullets flying at them. And we were able to move the sand around and put the beach back in the way we found it.
Can I ask you about another film that we mentioned in the lead when we introduced you, Shawshank Redemption?
Yes.
The producers for that film had already found the gothic-looking prison, but there was a specific scene that they really needed your help on. There's the character, played by Morgan Freeman, named Red, is released, and he needs to go and find something at a very specific location.
Mm-hmm. There's a big hayfield up near Buxton. You know where Buxton is?
There's a lot of hayfields up there.
One in particular. It's got a long rock wall with a big oak tree at the north end. It's like something out of a Robert Frost poem.
Anyone who has seen that film remembers that majestic tree.
Yes.
How did your team find that tree?
Well, we had the prison in Mansfield, Ohio, and we kind of drew a circle of a 30-mile radius, and we looked within that circle, and we came up with three or four trees, and that tree we wound up with was far and away the winner, how it sat in the field and how it was all alone. The owner of the field leased the field out to a farmer who grew alfalfa there, and he would take three harvests a year. And we wanted the field to look overgrown. So what we came up with was, okay, you can take the first cut. And that was done in the spring. And that's usually the cut that has the most nutrients in it. That's the best cut. And then after that, we don't want anything touched. We just wanted to leave it like it is. We want to put in the wall, which we did. But we then had to pay the farmer for the amount, the number of bales of hay he would have gotten out of that field. And then we put the wall in, and then we had a watering system, believe it or not, that would make stuff, moss and other stuff, grow on the wall. So by the time we were ready to film, it looked like it had been there forever.
Oh, so you had to age it.
Had to age it, yeah.
You know, when I go to a movie now and I'm watching these wonderful locations, I'm going to be thinking about you walking around with a manila folder filled with permits and maps where the cameras and the catering crews will be located.
Well, that's what I do.
Okay, now, true story. When I lived in Brooklyn, in a small apartment off of Court Street, a friend of mine was directing his first film and called me up and said, is it possible that I could use your apartment to film part of this movie? And I said, you know, that would be okay, but I started to tell him, you know, as you know, because you've seen it, I don't know if I really think that's going to work that well for you, because it's kind of sparsely furnished and it's pretty simple. And I was, you know, hadn't been there that long. I knew I was leaving. And he said, oh, no, no, that's perfect. That's perfect. And I realized that he wanted the apartment because the character in the movie is sort of down on his luck. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't think I can let you do it. I said, I just don't think I can be the loser apartment in the movie.
Hard to be a location scout.
Yeah.
But you can hear the full interview and see clips from some of the movies Ampa worked on our website, npr.org.
Next, we're going to hear from author Colson Whitehead about his novel Sag Harbor, which is a coming-of-age tale set among a group of friends in a summer in the mid-1980s in that predominantly African-American enclave on Long Island. Whitehead's previous works have earned him a Penn Oakland Award, a MacArthur Fellowship, often referred to as a genius grant, and he's even been a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. Tell Me More's Michelle Martin spoke to him about Sag Harbor.
You know, I was trying to figure out what from the summer of 1985 I could use, and luckily New Coke was there and Roxanne. So there, you know, there are a lot of different weird cultural moments that I was able to unpack, have fun with, sort of tease out their sort of broader implications, so that a New Coke is not just a New Coke. It's actually a horrible paradigm shift in this kid's life. And he has to come to grips with the fact that his world, yes, his world can change. So doing all that research with the music was, you know, incredibly fun. What's great about writing about 1985 is that it captures early hip-hop before it becomes very commercial, before it becomes gangsterized. And it's very quaint and silly. And so it's sort of lovely to see hip-hop in its early days again.
Some of the reviewers have noted your vivid analysis of such important terms as DAG. Now, for those who weren't around in the 80s, you helpfully define DAG as the bitter acknowledgement of the brutish machinery of the world. I'm just wondering if I'm doing it justice in the way. Can you? I think you should use it in a sentence.
Well, yeah. I mean, also, you need an audience. Like, if you stub your toe, you don't say DAG. It's DAG is best when someone slams the car door on your hand and you go, DAG. And then someone else says, that was cold. Like, you need someone else, like, you need a witness to this tragedy. And so, DAG, that was cold, is a sort of couplet that was very common.
I'm wondering, though, if you should have enclosed a CD with the proper use of these terms.
Well, you know, I try to pick good moments to use in readings. And so I have a whole, there's a thing where I analyze cursing patterns, profanity amongst these teenagers. And so when I do a reading, I have a little chart and I have a helpful pointer and I point out how to use these terms correctly.
And it's interesting because you talked about this being an innocent time. And of course, subsequently, there's been this big discussion about the N-word and whether it's appropriately used and whether, you know, cultural leaders like yourself should pave the way in eliminating this word from our vernacular. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I mean, in my case, it's art. And so I can't say that we didn't use it because we did use it. I certainly, you know, I have a 4.5-year-old and I don't use it in the house. I don't use the N-word around her. And times have changed. But if I didn't put it in the book, I'd be lying about how we used to talk and how we used to be with each other and how the word can have a different sort of meaning in this different context.
And you can hear the rest of our interview with Colson Whitehead and read an excerpt from Sag Harbor at the book section of our website, npr.org.
More literature on our docket. Matthew Pearl's written a new novel called The Last Dickens. It involves murder, drug runners, book pirates, and an unfinished Charles Dickens mystery. This is partly because the whole book is based, in part, on that writer's 1867 tour of America. Matthew Pearl spoke with NPR's Guy Raz from Boston, where Dickens began his journey.
When Charles Dickens arrived in Boston Harbor, where he started, they had to keep it secret because there was such a mob of people expecting him. And they actually chased down his carriage at the hotel, the Parker House Hotel, which is still here. And as he got out of the coach, people would rip parts of his coat off, his little strands of his shawl. And this is how it was the entire time. He really was our version of a rock star.
And he embarked on this tour, this reading tour of the United States. He'd read From Great Expectations and Oliver Twist. He did this in part to make money because he wasn't making money in the United States on his books. How was that possible?
we had a very strange copyright law, at least strange to our ears and eyes today, because we would not give copyright protection here in the United States to any foreign citizens. Well, what this meant is that someone like Charles Dickens could be published and printed by any newspaper, any publisher, without paying him a cent, either in advance or as royalties once copies were sold. Now, this was a bit of a double-edged sword because, on the one hand, Dickens lost untold amounts of money through this arrangement. On the other hand, he became extremely famous because there were so many editions and quite affordable editions of his books. So he was pretty savvy. He was upset at first for a while, going back about 20 years from his first trip to America. But he figured out how to exploit this by using the fame to earn money through, as you say, actual personal appearances. It was such a different time, but in a way he was inventing what we would know of as a book tour.
Paint a picture of this world of the wharves and the docks in places like Boston and Philadelphia and New York where you had these book pirates known as buccaneers.
This was so surprising to me when I was doing my research. It was one of these moments where I had to stare at the page. Since there was no copyright for foreign authors, the value in publishing a foreign author became who could publish it first, not who could get permission to publish it. So there was a race to intercept manuscripts and advance sheets from A-list writers by the pirating publishers in the United States, because if they could publish it first, it was worth simply thousands of dollars. So they sent these literary bounty hunters, what I call the buccaneers, to the wharfs in Boston, Philadelphia, and New York, and wait for shipments of new books to come in from Great Britain and a few other countries by messengers that were aboard ships to be delivered to certain publishers. So it really created this warfare right at the front lines to get the physical books. And that's something that's so much fun for me. Those were among my most favorite characters to write. And many of my readers point to them as their favorites as well.
Buccaneers and DAG are my two favorite words of the week.
I think that's fair. I agree. Buccaneers, DAG.
Beam me up.
Yeah.
There's a phrase that we're hearing a lot of recently.
That's exactly right. The new Star Trek movie is out. The franchise has certainly been powered by the advice to live long and prosper. And this past weekend, the new film, the 11th in the series, opened to very positive reviews and brought in north of $70 million in its first weekend. And it had enough crossover appeal to bring in the fan base, but also new folks who perhaps are not longtime fans. And at Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan had this review last week.
Here's a challenge. How do you implant an alien organism into a body that needs the implant but might die if things don't go just right? No, it's not the plot of an old Star Trek TV episode. It's the backstory of the new Star Trek motion picture. It's no secret that director J.J. Abrams was brought in to reformulate the venerable space opera franchise that was viewed as requiring a jolt of energy. He's been successful, partially because the new film has been positioned as Star Trek: The Young Years. Back we go to the maiden voyage of the Starship Enterprise and to the conversation between a young Jim Kirk and a Starfleet captain trying to get him to join up.
Enlist in Starfleet.
Enlist?
You guys must be way down on your recruiting quota for the month.
Not if you're half the man your father was, Jim. Starfleet could use you. You can be an officer in 4 years. You can have your own ship in 8. You understand what the Federation is, don't you? It's important. It's a peacekeeping and humanitarian armada.
We done?
I'm done.
The new Star Trek has come up with a serviceable, the Earth must be saved plot that involves science fiction staples like alternate realities and black holes. There's also a tattooed Romulan evildoer named Captain Nemo, who looks like the front man for a nasty rock band from the north of England. The plot is also the frame on which are hung the big-ticket action sequences all the Hollywood franchise movies simply have to have. But the traditional Star Trek embraced a utopian worldview that didn't depend on elaborate special effects for its effectiveness. Given the philosophical differences between the Star Trek created by Gene Roddenberry and what this movie had to include, it's amazing that the new venture works as well as it does. Live long and prosper, indeed.
Now, we should mention, Netta, that there is a little, you know, problem in that review, which is that as evil as the terrible villain is, it is Nero and not Captain Nemo.
Who is evil in a different movie.
Absolutely.
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Exactly. Well, you know, out in space, under the sea, it's all evil.
It's all scary.
That's exactly right. It's all scary.
Now, Linda, on the NPR blog Monkey See that you edit and write largely, what was your favorite thing from the very past week?
My favorite thing from this week was actually a post from our comic contributor, Glenn Weldon, who writes every Wednesday on Monkey See about comics and on the business side, on the creative side, all around. And he wrote this week about, as opposed to comic books, wrote about superheroes and wrote about fan films based on superheroes and had a wonderful breakdown of some of his favorite sort of fan-made films. So sometimes these are just stories that the fans wish to tell. Sometimes they are bringing together a wide variety of characters from different movies, and they have no rights to do any of this. They make them, they post them in various places. They come up with their own sets and costumes and often highly questionable acting. And
on Monkey See, you post a clip from one called Batman Dead End.
That's right. Batman Dead End is one where he talks about this film. They include additional information about Batman, additional stories, and that he has a wonderful confrontation between Batman and the Joker.
You're pathetic.
Oh, that's rich, coming from someone who runs around in the dark, wearing a cape and a mask.
We both wear masks.
Look at my face. This is who I am. My mask is permanent. You have a choice.
You made your choice a long Joker.
No! You did this to me, and you condemned me to that asylum like some bastard child that you refuse to take responsibility for!
It's amazing when you see it, and I had to check what the background was with the people who did the movie. And, you know, they've been working kind of in the margins of the Hollywood industry for a while. There's a reason why it really looks so good.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the guy who plays the Joker is the son of the guy who played the original Chekhov in Star Trek.
Uh-huh.
It all comes together.
It does.
Culturetopia.
It does.
You can subscribe to the Culturetopia podcast at npr.org.
Or you can see all of the stories that we talked about this week or listen online at npr.org/Culturetopia.
I'm Netta Ulaby.
And I'm Linda Holmes.
See you next week.